Well, tonight we continue our series on church history. This is part three of Islam and the Church. We're using Nick Needham's 2,000 Years of Christ's Power, his five volumes on church history. We're in the second volume, beginning of the Middle Ages. Remember, Middle Ages is this middle period between the patristic period of the early church fathers going into the 600s AD and the Protestant Reformation of the 16th century, of the 1500s AD. Middle period between the patristic period and the Protestant Reformation or the Middle Ages, assigned by church historians. Middle Ages began in the 600s with the rise of Islam. In the 600s, they, through their conquests, ended the controversy with the Chalcedonians and the Monophysites within Christianity. That was the big controversy, you remember. Their conquests of Syria and Egypt, in particular, ended that controversy in the Byzantine Empire. And then the Frankish Empire as well arose in the 600s that will reach its peak with Charlemagne in 800 AD. Islam, though, is the big thing that triggers this great conflict with the church. We've covered Muhammad himself, born 570-571. No one's really sure exact date. 570-571 AD. Remember, the first biography of him was done 150 years after his death. It's a long time, so we don't know how accurate it is, technically. Well, he, all by himself in a cave, no other witnesses, claimed to have received revelation from a messenger, an angel, Gabriel, from God. Allah is the Arabic word for God. It's a big, big point for me because Christianity is grounded in eyewitness accounts. We're empirical. And truth is established by two or more witnesses in Deuteronomy 19. And we know in Galatians 1, 8, 9, if anyone, even an angel, comes preaching a different gospel than the one the apostles shared with us from Christ, let him be anathema, let him be cursed. And what we have here is a different gospel. It's a works-based religion, Islam. I won't go into all of the military conquests that he had, but he died 632 AD. We went through the new religion, the basic part of it that he established. There's three main authoritative texts, in a sense. The Quran that he wrote, 114 messages broken down into what's called surahs. He dictated it, so he just supposedly claims he heard the words and then dictated it down. Remember, the third caliph, the third successor after Muhammad's death, his name was Uthman. He collected all of the contradictory texts of the Quran and burned all of them except one that he claimed was the legitimate text. Uthman was 644 to 656, if I recall correctly, AD. That's why they only have one text, and they claim the Bible has contradictions because of all the various copies we have. But actually, the Bible is the most accurate of all ancient texts. And the only reason that they claim they have no contradictions is because they only have one text and the third caliph burned all the rest. Okay? You've got to remember that when you're defending Christianity against Islam. They had five pillars: confession of faith, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet, simple confession. Part of those five pillars, he essentially copied from Jesus in Matthew 6, 1 through 18, because the second and third and fourth pillars are dealing with charitable giving. Muslims have a duty to give money to the poor. Deals with prayer, although Muslims say you must pray five times a day facing Mecca. And then fasting, and then they fast during the month of Ramadan once a year, usually during the daytime hours. And then the fifth is to try and make a pilgrimage to Mecca at least once in your lifetime. Remember, he established the most holy place from the ancient pagan shrine, Kaaba, in Mecca. Once he conquered it with his 10,000 warriors, it spread through warfare, as we have detailed. Remember, there's the jihad. It's not part of the five pillars, but jihad is for the holy struggle. Personal struggle for holiness, trying to obey Allah's will. It's a works-based religion. As well, it's a struggle to make Islam dominant as a religion in the whole world. And they will spread it by four things. Remember, Islam means submit. And it will spread by preaching. If you don't submit there, they'll spread by writing. If you don't submit, then they have spread by politics and diplomacy. Which, as we've said, when they immigrate here to the Western world, practically all of them vote because that's a part of their religion. To spread Islam and make it the dominant religion through diplomacy and politics. But if you don't submit to preaching, writing, and diplomacy, politics, warfare is what's next. And as we saw, that's what they did, is they, within 100 years, through warfare, swept through half the Byzantine Empire, what had been Catholic Christianity. Within a few years after Muhammad's death is where they swept through Antioch, they swept through Syria, they swept through Egypt, and they swept through Persia. And then they moved on with a 50-year violent, bloody conquest of Northwest Africa and the Berbers, the natural tribal group that was there. The Berbers eventually embraced Islam. The Berbers, as Muslims, then invaded Spain in 711 AD, conquered it by 718 AD. And then they entered France. And you remember it was the Battle of Tours in France, 732 AD, exactly 100 years after Muhammad's death, where General Charles Martel, and you remember Martel is French for hammer. They met a hammer they couldn't crack, and that hammer crushed them. And historians, Gibbons and all sorts of various historians, that, as Nick Needham says, marked, in his mind, the permanent stopping of the Western expansion of Islam. And then Islam stayed in Spain for 700 years until Ferdinand in 1492, Spanish King Ferdinand, repelled the Muslims out of Spain, which allowed Columbus to sail the ocean blue for North America. The other conquest you remember was the fifth caliph, a very important battle, the fifth caliph, Muawiyah. Muawiyah, you remember, he thought he would take Constantinople and had a 5-year siege against Constantinople in 673 to 678 AD. He was unable to take Constantinople. Remember, the Byzantine Empire had a secret weapon they called Greek fire. There's no record of exactly what it was, but it was like the nuclear bomb of that time. By the grace of God, they had this secret weapon, even burned like crazy, furiously on water. And it was such a secret in the Byzantine Empire, no record of it came down to us. It was lost in history. But because of the effects of it, we know that in the Black Sea and the Caucasus region that was in the Byzantine Empire, light crude oil would bubble up to the surface. Historians and scientists think it was light crude oil, sulfur, and pitch from a tree. That mixture created this fire that burned ferociously, even on water. To take on a naval fleet, which the Muslims had, as well their armies. But it was Constantine IV then in 678, Battle of Selimium, that defeated the Muslims. That was the very first time they had a 100% defeat by Constantine IV, 678 AD. And the other one that we mentioned was the Battle of Tours in 732 in France. It's the only way they were repelled was with military might. Let me just say that to you bluntly. Islam means submit. If you're not going to submit to the preaching, the writing, or the politics, diplomacy, warfare is coming. And it was only warfare by Christian societies that stopped it, ever. We had mentioned, and it was very important, that Jesus' words in Mark 3, 20-27, and Matthew 12, 22-28, that a kingdom divided against itself shall not stand. The kingdom divided against itself cannot stand. The Byzantine Empire was divided in Christendom there, in Christianity, between the Chalcedonians, following the Chalcedonian Creed of 451, which we follow, that Christ is truly God, truly man, two natures in one person, that division between the Chalcedonians and the Monophysites made them weak against the Muslim assault. We mentioned that that later on will be the weakness of the Muslim Islamic Empire. They ended up being divided, as we mentioned last time we met, between Shia and Sunni. Shias have always been a minority, roughly 10 to 15% of Muslims. They centered in Persia, which is present-day Iran. Shias said that the descendants that rule the Islamic Empire, the caliphs, or the imams, the living leaders, must be a blood descendant of Muhammad. But they were an extreme minority, 10, 15%. Sunnis were those that said, no, the leader does not have to be a blood descendant of Muhammad. Either the various leaders of the nations conquered, the regions conquered by Muslims, they can pick the caliph, the leader, or the caliph himself can pick a successor. But what's more important to the Sunnis, which is then 85, 90% of Muslims, what's more important to them are the authoritative documents of the Quran, written by Muhammad, 114 messages, the Hadith, which is the traditions or sayings of Muhammad, along with his life experiences as a model to live, the Hadith, and then the third is the Ijma, I-J-M-A, which is the consensus of Islamic legal scholars. Sunnis say that's most important, more than the living leader. Okay, but they were divided, so that made them weak, because then, as we said, the third caliph gets assassinated, he's a Sunni, he gets replaced by a Shia. He gets assassinated, gets replaced by a Sunni. They have a civil war going on. Well, what also made them divided, as we pointed out, is by the 700s, then they had basically conquered half the Byzantine Empire. They were turned back in 732 by the Battle of Tours in Tours, France, by General Charles Martel. But they were across Spain, across Northwest Africa, across Egypt. So they controlled Alexandria, that had been a patriarch of the Catholic Church. They controlled Palestine, where Jerusalem was a patriarch of the Catholic Church. They defeated Antioch, where there was a patriarch of the Catholic Church. So now there's only two leaders left in the Catholic Church, which is bipolar then. One in Rome, one in Constantinople, which will then lead with Charlemagne, separation of politics and religion separately east-west, which will pave the way for the Great Schism. But they control all through Persia. They control all the way to India. And then they as well conquer Afghanistan. They start independence, though. Many of them go independent in the 700s. Spain went independent 756 AD, as we mentioned. Morocco, Tunisia, Libya, they went independent in Northwest Africa as well in the 700s. Persia went independent in 700s AD. Egypt went independent in the 900s AD. So they're saying, we're going to be Muslim, but we're going to govern ourselves. Okay? But they're becoming fractured then and independent. Not just Shia and Sunni in division and civil war, but then they become fractured as well. So that will pave the way for the Crusades, the reconquest of Christian land by the Christian crusaders to come down and take back Christian land with the physical sword. A kingdom divided against itself cannot stand. So that's a warning shot for us in America. We're so divided in politics between the Democrat, crazy, woke, communist people and those who are Republican trying to be traditional Americans on the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution. We're so divided that we are exposing ourselves as well to being conquered. A kingdom divided against itself cannot stand. Well, tonight we're going to look at here number five in the outline. We're continuing here in the outline, number five. Life for the church under Islamic rule. Life for the church under Islamic rule. What was it like? I want to go through a little bit of the details of kind of how it operated, and then we'll look at how Christians were treated. What I did is on the first side of the board here, here and there, I have people mentioned just a simple statement about them. I've got more details to share with you. I wanted to make sure I have room on the back. The backboard is filled with those who defended Christianity in the Middle Ages. What were their arguments against Islam? And it is so important because we need to make the same arguments against Islam today. Okay? Islam hasn't changed. We've got all of these immigrants that are Muslim around us in the United States of America. There's a higher percent in Western Europe, actually, than here. They're in a perilous position right now in Western Europe, much more than we. I should say this. In America, they're the ones having children like crazy. I worked with one Muslim lady that transferred to a different Walmart up, I think, in St. Cloud area. A friend of hers just told me she just had her seventh child. Okay, they're having children massively. And as you and I know, most Americans are not. That alone will spread Islam, because we're going to see, historically, it was the death penalty for a Muslim to convert to Christianity. And they banned personal evangelism to Muslims. Okay, so there's a lot that has to be overcome. You have free speech in the United States of America, so we can personally evangelize them. Okay, in America. But I say, you try that over in Iran. You know, go for it. Afghanistan, go for it and see what happens to you, how long you live. Okay? Right? We know you're not going to live very long. Because they're still under these historic principles. Okay? But the back of the board is going to be thinking apologetically, how do we defend Christianity? How do we critique Islam? Okay? And argue their falsehoods. Very important. So the front of the board here, what was it like for the church under Islamic rule? Muslims regarded each caliph, which, as we said, the successors of Muhammad, they were the ones who ruled the Islamic empire. Each one of them was a successor to Muhammad in their minds. Caliphs resided first in Damascus, which is Syria, in the east. And after 750 AD, the ruler was centered in Baghdad, which is present-day Iraq. Okay, so the caliphs first resided in Damascus in Syria, and then from the 750 onward in Baghdad, which is Iraq today. Their huge territories were divided into provinces called emirates. And we have like the UAE, United Arab Emirates, over there in the Persian Gulf. That's the history where they get that term. Okay, is their provinces were called emirates after they conquered much of Christendom. An emir governed each emirate on the caliph's behalf, like a governor of a state, in a sense. All the ancient empires did this, the Persian Empire, the Roman Empire. All of them broke things down into provinces and then had someone in charge, and then they were accountable to the top dog, right? So they've done the same thing in an administrative sense. Caliph at the top, broken into provinces called emirates, and an emir governed each province, each emirate, accountable to the caliph, the top dog. From one perspective, Muslims tolerated those of other faiths that they conquered. And this is very important to understand. Toleration, religious toleration, is not religious liberty. Very different. Why is this so important? Because the Muslim that won the Democrat primary in the state of Michigan, that is running for the U.S. Senate, he was being interviewed on Jesse Waters' show just this last week, and he was trying to argue that there's been religious liberty in Islamic societies, as there's liberty here. And I about fell off my chair. You know, they lie through their teeth. Toleration is not liberty. Muslims claim to be the true religion. And when they conquered these areas, they didn't kill every last soul of other faiths. Okay? They would tolerate those of other faiths. All Arabs, though, that ethnicity, all Arabs were bound forever to Islam. Period. They were expected to be Muslim. Well, what do we mean that they tolerated? Well, in Persia, so the Muslims conquered Persia, present-day Iran, the Zoroastrians were the pagans in Persia that were more of a dualistic faith. They were allowed to continue their faith as long as they followed the conditions of their conquerors. That's the key in all of this, in toleration. Muhammad regarded Christians and Jews as corrupting the true religion, as corrupting true religion. They were allowed to continue and exist and have their faith as long as they followed all sorts of conditions of their conquerors, the Muslims. So there were Monophysite churches in Syria and Egypt. Remember, Syriac language in Syria, Coptic language in Egypt. So they had distinct languages, and they tended to have their distinct views of who Jesus was. Monophysite is one nature, remember. This blending of human divine, or the humans lost in the divine as a drop of wine in the ocean. You know, that type of a thing. Which we rejected that, the Council of Chalcedon, 451 AD. Well, in Persia, there were the Nestorians. Remember, the Nestorians said that two natures, two persons. Crazy enough. That's who Jesus was. The Nestorians, two natures, two persons. Well, they had been rejected as well. But they were allowed to continue under Muslim control in Persia as long as they didn't violate certain conditions. Amazingly, in Damascus, where the caliph governed up until 750, in Damascus, in Syria, there, Christians and Muslims shared the church of St. John for worship. It's kind of interesting. As long as those, they followed certain conditions. You say, well, what are these conditions? That's the second arrow. This is the idea of toleration. For Islam, for Muslims, they're the true religion, and everybody else is second class. A second class citizen. So Christians in the Islamic Empire became second class citizens, and they had to live in segregated communities. They were organized under a bishop, but that bishop was accountable to Muslims. It's kind of like how the church functions in communist China. If you're going to be in any way public, you're accountable to the communist leader. What is permitted and what isn't. A treaty was formed, is usually the way it worked. Let me just say this real quick. Dhimma, D-H-I-M-M-A. And they were protected, quote-unquote, under this condition of dhimmitude. But they had to follow all these conditions, such as paying a heavy poll tax for this, quote-unquote, protection. Actually, I would call it extortion. You either follow along with this or we'll kill you. That's Islam. Remember, for Muslims, for Islam, the greatest attribute of God, of Allah, is power. Might makes right for Muslims. They respect power, period. But for this quote-unquote protection that they agreed to in this treaty that they were forced to sign, they had to pay a heavy poll tax. Poll tax means same amount per person. Same amount per person. And you're paying that to the Muslims to support their religion and society and politics, okay? Their military. Christians were required to wear distinctive clothing, marking them out as Christians in society. Christians were forbidden to own swords or horses. They take away your right of self-defense. Today, they'd be confiscating all your guns. They banned Christians from publicly displaying crosses or icons of anything Christian. No symbols of anything Christian publicly. No free speech, really, even through symbols. They did not permit Christians to ring bells. Traditionally, we have bells at the top of churches, ringing for worship service, calling everyone to worship service. Christians were not permitted to ring bells or beat drums to announce their Christian worship services. But now I've seen video in New York City where the Muslims have their calls to worship going across loudspeakers across the city. Muslims banned Christians from marrying Muslims. I'm sure Christians would be, we're fine with that. Okay. And then the Muslims banned Christians from personally evangelizing Muslims. No free speech. So Christians were banned from personally trying to go up to a Muslim and try and personally evangelize them and convert them to Christianity. And any conversion from Islam to Christianity was punished by death. Hard to get a conversion that way, especially when travel is not as easy as it is today. That's the idea of toleration. Okay? Toleration. That is not religious liberty, and I don't care what anyone says in our day, lying through their teeth. Now, not surprisingly, the churches under Islamic rule declined in numbers in all these areas that the Muslims controlled. Christian churches declined in numbers facing this, being a second-class citizen. Many Christians, in fact, converted to Islam, Nick Needham points out. Apostatized and converted to Islam in order to enjoy full citizenship. Now, despite tolerance on paper, many Christians were violently persecuted, especially in local areas. Despite on paper having these treaties, of the Zima Treaty. In fact, one caliph, Al-Hakim, decreed systematic persecution of Christians in 1015 to 1020 AD, is what Nick Needham points out. There was one caliph that literally decreed it, officially persecute Christians for 5 years. Now, it's fascinating to me is that's right before the Crusades. Like we've had enough. Crusade started in the 11th century. Nick Needham does point out, by the way, there's a difference between Catholic Christians in the East and Catholic Christians in the West. Catholic Christians in the West despised Islam much more than Catholic Christians in the East. Catholic Christians in the East tended to respect a bit more of their civilization, okay? But the Crusades will be coming from the West. Despite widespread persecution, surprisingly, many Christians did flourish as Muslims employed Christians and Jews as civil servants. They have this vast empire. Now think with me. Think with me. Remember when we talked about the Germanic tribes, when they came down and conquered Western Europe, conquered Rome, 410 AD, the various Germanic tribes, the Vandals, the Visigoths, and the various ones, great at killing, they were barbarians, but they couldn't govern once they conquered. So then what they did is they employed Catholics, Romans, to help them administer. Right? So you have the same thing here. Muslims great at killing, but they can't govern. So what do? Ah, just like the Babylonians employing Daniel and his friends, right? Or Pharaoh employing Joseph, for example, right, in Egypt. But we need help in administration. We need some wisdom here. So that's what they did. So there were many Christians and Jews employed by the Muslims as civil servants. As well, in Persia, Muslims employed various Nestorian Christian scholars to translate the great works of Greek philosophy into Arabic. The Muslims were very interested in ancient Greek philosophy. Aristotle and Plato and Euclid and others. And we brought that up a little bit last time we met with a couple of the Muslims that were very astute and intellectual, especially in Greek philosophy. There was a Nestorian Christian, Hussein ibn Ishaq, he died 877 AD, he headed the university in Baghdad. After 750 AD, the caliph headed himself in Baghdad. Well, there was a university in Baghdad of the Muslims. A Christian headed that university, translating writings of Aristotle and Euclid into Arabic. Kind of interesting. Another, Timothy the First, I have him on the board there, 728 to 823 AD. Nick Needham says he's the most distinguished thinker and writer under Muslim rule, and he wrote a classic work of Christian apologetics addressing Muslims, and it's called Dialogue with Al-Mahdi. Dialogue with Al-Mahdi. Al-Mahdi was actually a caliph in Islam from 775 to 785 AD. So he's writing a dialogue similar to Plato's dialogues, interacting as a Christian with the caliph, with his Muslim beliefs. Timothy I there was 728 to 823 AD. John of Damascus, he lived 675 to 749 AD. Nick Needham describes him as the most outstanding Christian under Muslim rule. So under Muslim rule, who were the ones that stood out the most? So Timothy the First was one as the most distinguished thinker and writer under Muslim rule. John of Damascus, the most outstanding Christian overall under Muslim rule. John of Damascus was prime minister of a caliph. And then he lived in a monastery near Jerusalem after being a prime minister for a caliph. He wrote what's called the Fountain of Knowledge. John of Damascus wrote the Fountain of Knowledge. Now, think in your mind, John of Damascus was born roughly 45 years after Muhammad died. Okay? He wrote the Fountain of Knowledge. It's in three parts. First part is dealing with questions of philosophy. The second part dealt with heresies. And the third part was titled The Exact Exposition of the Orthodox Faith. Okay? John of Damascus wrote The Fountain of Knowledge. It's in three parts. First part, questions of philosophy. Second part, dealing with heresies of Christianity. And the third part, The Exact Exposition of the Orthodox Faith. This is a quote from Nick Needham. He says, what John of Damascus wrote here in that third part, he says, it's one of the most profound and influential presentations of Eastern Chalcedonian theology ever written, unquote. Notice Chalcedonian theology. John of Damascus opposed both Nestorianism, saying Jesus is two natures, two persons. We reject that. He opposed Nestorianism, and he opposed Monophysitism, saying there's this blending of human and divine into one nature. We reject that. We never deify the human nor humanize the divine. And it's not that as human is lost in the divine. Jesus is truly God, truly man, two natures in one person, and they are not mixed or confused, the two natures. He based his teaching on the Cappadocian fathers. Remember, they're the ones that carried the torch after Athanasius against Arianism in the 300s. Cappadocian fathers, so they were defending Christ in two natures in one person. As well, they went into the First Council of Constantinople, 381 AD, on the full-blown Trinity proclamation, biblical Trinity. So he opposed Nestorianism, he opposed Monophysitism, he based his teaching on the Cappadocian fathers, and he included developments in Christology, such as Maximus the Confessor. Remember, he led the charge against, oh, it's energy that's united in Jesus, or, oh, it's united in his will. No, we reject that as well. He's including all of that in that third section of the exact exposition of the Orthodox faith. Interestingly, in short, they call it the Orthodox faith, was translated into Latin in the 12th century. So he wrote it in Greek. Right? Remember, East and West from the Roman Empire, the West was Latin primarily, East was Greek. So John of Damascus is in Syria in the East. What is he doing? He's writing in the Greek language. Well, it's finally translated the Orthodox faith into Latin in the 12th century, in the 1100s AD. And Nick Needham again says it's one of the most profound and influential presentations of Eastern Chalcedonian theology ever written. Makes me want to buy it and read it. I don't own it. Makes me want to, though. Get a load of this. I found this very fascinating. John of Damascus also wrote a religious novel, a religious Christian novel titled Barlaam and Josaphat. B-A-R-L-A-A-M, Barlaam and Josaphat, J-O-S-A-P-H-E-T, a Christian novel, and it is one of the most widely read books in the history of the Byzantine Empire. Isn't that fascinating? Now, Christians under Muslim rule, where was the area where they were most tolerated, most fruitful, in their relationship with Muslims? And it was in Muslim Spain. The most tolerant and fruitful Christian-Muslim relationships were in Muslim Spain. The Islamic Empire called it the Emirate of Cordova. Remember, the provinces are divided up in emirates, and they would call it the Emirate of Cordova. In 756 AD is when Muslim Spain became an independent Muslim state, which we've already noted. The Berber Muslims that came from Northwest Africa and conquered Spain, they're also called Moors in Spain, M-O-O-R-S, which many have come across, the Moors, M-O-O-R-S, that's the Berber Muslims. So I thought that was worth noting. Many Christian communities, but not all, in Muslim Spain survived unmolested for centuries. But there were many Christian martyrs, is what McNeita points out, nonetheless, in Muslim Spain. But as long as the Christians did not criticize Islam or personally evangelize them, they were tolerated pretty much in Muslim Spain. Western Christian scholars often visited famous Spanish Muslim universities to learn philosophy, mathematics, astronomy, and medicine. Muslim universities were very academic in Spain. Many Christians would go there and study philosophy, mathematics, astronomy, and medicine. You go back to Augustine of Hippo, died 430 AD, and remember, he would say, when the Israelites left Egypt, God commanded them to take gold nuggets, the gold and silver and valuables from Egypt, with them, right? This is where Augustine of Hippo and others of the early church fathers would say, we go to even the pagans or to the Muslims, and there are some things, there are some nuggets of truth that are there that we can mine for and utilize for Christian purposes. And Christians would go there and, okay, I'll study philosophy, which is more science, and then math and astronomy and medicine, and go back to France, the Franks, the Frankish Empire, and use the knowledge gained for Christian purposes. Okay, Christian responses to Islam. 6 in the outline. Christian responses to Islam. Obviously, you basically have 2, right? Christian nations had 2 possible ways to stop the spread of Islam. Either by the physical sword, warfare, which, again, that's Constantinople, stopped the Islamic siege, the 5-year siege of Muawiyah, that 5th caliphate. How? By war. How did the Franks stop them? By war. Battle of Tours, 732. Either stop the spread of Islam by the physical sword or by the pen, by writing. By writing. Personal evangelism within their countries was prohibited, but various articles and things could be written, books, treatises. Since Islam spread by military armies, Christian nations resisted with defensive warfare. It fits to a T Augustine's just war theory. Christians were defending life and property in their civilization from the onslaught of Muslim armies. You couldn't get a more clear definition of a just war. Remember, writing books does not repel invading armies. Am I going to hit them over the head with a book, you know? It's just, the only thing that's going to stop them coming at you with soldiers with swords is swords. But notwithstanding the defense of Christian societies with military armies, there were notable attempts by Christians to use writings to try and, in that sense, evangelize Muslims through treatises and writings and dialogues and all of that in the written form. Two great Christian leading missions to the Islamic world were the founder of the Franciscan order, Francis of Assisi, lived 1182 to 1226 AD. We're going to have more to say on him up ahead, so we don't say much on him right now. Nick Needham's got more on him up ahead. Okay, Francis of Assisi founded the Franciscan order. And Raymond Lull lived 1232 to 1316 AD, contemporary of Thomas Aquinas. Let's say a little bit about Raymond Lull. Lull had been a womanizer before his conversion to Christianity. Okay? That's who he was. Through the death of a woman he was infatuated with, he got his attention. God used it to convert him to Christianity. He renounced the sinful world, Raymond Lull did, and he joined the Franciscan order that Francis of Assisi had started. Raymond Lull learned Arabic. He had purchased a Muslim slave for freedom, granted the slave freedom, but said, "Teach me Arabic." So he learned Arabic from this Spanish Muslim slave that he purchased and set free. And then he established a Franciscan convent on an island off the coast of Spain. So he's got this island off Muslim Spain where Christianity can be in control of. And he starts a convent there with monks in the Franciscan order. And then he teaches the monks Arabic. So they'll be able to write in Arabic and communicate to Muslims, where Arabic's their language. It's said that Raymond Lull went on three missionary journeys to Tunisia and Algeria in northwest Africa. One tradition, though, says he narrowly escaped, and another says he was martyred there. So we don't fully know in history what happened to him. But Lull wrote treatises on Christianity in Arabic. In Arabic. So I'd be saying, like, how do we reach the Kurdan people who don't know any English over there in Burma? Well, one way is for people here to write Christian treatises in Kurdish so that they can read them over there. That's what he's doing here, right? In their native language, writing Christian treatises. As well, he influenced Pope Clement V, who was Pope 1305 to 1314 AD, Pope of Rome, he convinced him to include Arabic teachers and other Eastern tongues at Christian universities, where areas where Christians controlled, we had universities at the time, and he convinced the Pope to include the teaching of Arabic and other Eastern languages at these Christian universities in order to understand, refute, and evangelize Muslims. That was his purpose, like the Wycliffe of his day. Raymond Lull. The church in the Middle Ages produced a lot of Christian writings, exposing the falsehood of Muhammad's religion, as well as defending Christianity. It's similar to the apologies, the defenses of Christianity that the early church fathers did against Roman paganism. And here, we have Christians writing apologies, defenses of the Christian faith against Islam. Leading Christian apologists were John of Damascus, that we talked about, the 675 to 749. He was in the east, right? Damascus in Syria. And then Thomas Aquinas and Raymond Lull in the west. Thomas Aquinas lived 1225 to 1274 AD, and Raymond Lull, he was 1232 to 1316. Christian apologists in the Middle Ages against Islam focused on two points. That's what we're going to focus on the back and forth. These are things we can focus on today, talking with Muslims, okay? One is on Muhammad himself. Claims of Muhammad, particularly his person, as well as his writings, so we're defending the New Testament. The second point that they focused on in defending Christianity and showing the falsehood of Islam is on doctrines. Doctrines of the Trinity, the Incarnation, the sovereignty of God, and pure worship versus idolatrous worship. Okay? So, the first point, dealing with claims of Muhammad as a person. He's the founder of this new religion, came up with it, supposedly, right, from the angel Gabriel in a cave outside of Mecca. Remember, there was no eyewitnesses, just him. That is a complete weakness in my mind. Truth is established by two or more witnesses. They frame Muhammad as a deliberate deceiver. A deliberate deceiver. This is important. They're not saying, oh, he's one who was deceived. No, they're saying he is an intentional liar. He is an intentional deceiver. He's a deliberate deceiver who formed his new religion from Jewish myths and Christian heresies. This was their argument. Remember I said a couple of points where he's borrowing from Judeo-Christianity. Their calendar, the Islamic calendar, starts from the Exodus. Remember, very early on, the tribal pagans in Mecca, militarily, through persecution, forced Muhammad and his followers to flee out of Mecca, and they went north to Medina. Well, in that Exodus is where it starts their calendar. Well, we know the Jews started their calendar of their when their Exodus took place out of Egypt. You see, he's copying that. You see. And then part of the three out of the five pillars of Islam copy the three parts of religion Jesus had in Matthew 6 in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 6, 1 through 18. Okay. What the devil always does is he copies and warps. The power of a lie is its closest to the truth. There's copying and twisting and including Jewish myths and Christian heresies within it. Within it. And we're going to talk about some of it too with Christ. So he denies the deity of Christ, denies he died on the cross. We'll be dealing with specifics here on some of his assertions. But up here again. Claims of Muhammad. The Christian apologists identified him as the false prophet in the book of Revelation. That was a common thing that they did. Remember what he's saying? Muhammad is saying that Christians got the true religion wrong and the Jews got the true religion wrong, and then he's getting it right. That's what he's claiming. They also exposed his sinful sexual indulgence. After his first wife died, he took on 14 wives, at least 14 wives, and several concubines, several mistresses. Remember when he was 25, he was working for a wealthy widow as a trader in the Middle East, and he married her. And they had several children together. But she was older than he was. When she died, then he took on 14 wives at least and several concubines. So they exposed his sinful sexual indulgence. This is your leader. This is the founder of this new religion. They also pointed out that he was not a true prophet because since the time of Christ and the apostles, there should be no new doctrine or moral revelations. Revelation 22:18. Nothing is to be added Not just nothing is to be subtracted, but nothing is to be added. The canon is closed. No more revelations until Christ comes again. Right? That's the biblical assertion. So they denied he was a true prophet, claiming additional revelations. Hey, you're adding to Scripture, and Scripture says there will be no adding, no new revelation until Christ returns. Muhammad claimed to be the second paraclete, the second helper that Jesus talked about in the upper room with the disciples celebrating Passover in John chapters 14, 15, and 16. Jesus said, I'm going to send this another paraclete, another helper to you. He claims to be that paraclete. So the Christian apologists denied that Muhammad was the second paraclete from John chapters 14, 15, and 16, as the Muslims asserted. And we know that it's the Holy Spirit Jesus was referring to. It's the Holy Spirit that was poured out at Pentecost, as recorded in Acts chapter 2, right? As well, the Christian apologists defended the New Testament against Muslim claims that Christians corrupted it, which is this whole point of what he, as a prophet, claiming to dictate and write down the Quran and the 114 messages, contradicting things in the New Testament. And he's claiming, oh, I'm getting it right. You're the ones that have corrupted it, saying Jesus was crucified or that Jesus was truly God, rose bodily from the dead after his crucifixion. You're the one that corrupted it. Well, they were defending the New Testament. Okay, so those were some claims of Muhammad, him as a person, etc., that they dealt with. The second one, which covers the Trinity, the Incarnation, divine sovereignty, and worship, was the conflict that Christians and Muslims had over doctrines, claims of assertions of truth of God centered on the Trinity, the Incarnation, divine sovereignty, and questions of pure worship versus idolatrous worship. So let's go down each of these. We're talking with Muslims. The Trinity. Christians defended the oneness of God. What is so beautifully stated at the Council of Constantinople, 381 AD, Council of Chalcedon, 451 AD, God is three persons in one essence. One substance, one essence. We defend the oneness of God. What's unique is he happens to be three persons in one essence. It's a mystery. They claim we are pagans and reject the oneness of God. They're thinking by asserting three persons, there must be three different substances, three different essences, three different substances or natures, three gods. So they regard us as having three gods by not understanding the Trinity. And so the Christian apologists defended the Trinity to them, saying, we defend the oneness of God. It's just mysterious. He's three persons in one essence. Behold, the Lord our God is one. Okay, next, the Incarnation. Christians defended Christ's deity, that he's truly God, not just truly man. Truly God, truly man, two natures in one person. The Muslims, the Islamic religion, claims Jesus is merely a human prophet. Muslims claim Jesus is merely a human prophet. Now, let me tell you a little story that happened to me in the last week. It was kind of fascinating. So many of you know, I also work at Walmart, and there's several Muslims that work at Walmart. And there's one that I've worked with before on my crew, and then she's on a different crew now. We talk here and there, and she came by. She forgot on a Saturday that the next day was Sunday. She says, well, what are you doing tomorrow? I said, oh, tomorrow's Sunday. And she goes, oh, that's right, you'll be at church. I said, that's right, I'm a Christian pastor. I've told her that. And I looked at her, I said, do you know why Christians come together to worship on Sundays? Do you know why? She said, no. I said, well, I know you as Muslims believe Jesus was a prophet, but you believe he was a mere man. I said, we come together, Christians, to worship on Sundays because Christ rose bodily from the dead on Sunday, proving he's truly God. And that's why we worship on Sunday. And she just kind of looked at me, and turned and walked away, but it gives her something to think about, right? But this is where we can ask certain questions. I say, ask a question. Jesus' modus operandi typically with opponents was very subtle, to ask a question. See what they say. And she didn't know why Christians meet on Sunday. That gave me a door to speak to her about the deity of Christ. I said, and I have faith in him, that he was crucified for my sins, and I have forgiveness in him, and he rose bodily from the dead early Sunday morning, proving he's truly God, and that I can be forgiven of sins in him. And as she was walking away, that's what I said. The Christian apologist also noted that in the Quran, it says Christ was virgin-born. In Surah 3, we have 114 surahs, 114 messages, Surah 3, 45 to 47. As well, the Quran calls Jesus the, quote, Word of God. In Surah 4, 171. Those were things that they would point out, the Christian apologists. Now remember, we noted this, Nick Needham noted it. Islam asserts that Jesus was virgin-born, sinless, a miracle worker, a prophet, but not as great of a prophet as Muhammad. He's the greatest prophet in their mind. And Jesus was not truly God, and Jesus was not crucified. In their minds, Allah would never have been a prophet to be crucified. So the big things we have to assert, again, with Muslims is the Trinity. Understand, three persons, one essence. We defend the oneness of God. Make sure they understand that. We don't worship three gods. And in the Incarnation, to make it clear to them, we believe he's truly God and truly man, two natures in one person. And he proved it through the eyewitness accounts of the bodily resurrection from the dead. He said, I will give them the sign of Jonah. 3 days and three nights in the belly of the whale, and he will rise again. And he did. That's the sign of all signs that proves his deity, that they rejected and regarded him as blasphemous and crucified him. Truly God, and we have to defend that clearly to them. So the Trinity, the Incarnation, divine sovereignty. Divine sovereignty. We had mentioned it, I think last time we met, the Muslims in Islam say that Allah is the cause of all things, both evil and good. They're literally asserting God is the author of evil. That's what they're asserting. And for the Christian apologists defending Christianity, they're saying, Muslims, that's a blasphemous statement. You're blaspheming God, saying he's the author of evil. So the Christian apologists, they said God is the cause of all good. Every good and perfect gift is from God, James 1:17. But God is not the cause of evil. He himself tempts no one to sin, James 1:13. Indeed, God creates and sustains the will that does evil. Acts 17:28. In God we live and move and have our very being, our existence. The very will, the human will, or angelic will who sins for the fallen angels, that very will is sustained by God, the existence of it. Our existence depends on God. Our very being. God is the one who holds all things together, Colossians 1:17. Even the will that sins. God permits that will to do evil, like Romans 1:24, 26, and 28. God gives them over. God permits humans and angels to do evil if they so choose. God exploits that evil for good whenever he so chooses, such as with Joseph's brothers in Genesis chapter 50, verse 20, where Joseph said, "You guys meant it for evil when you sold me into slavery. God meant it for good." God can exploit sinful deeds for good. He works all things together for good, all things, even evil things. God works all things together for good to those that love him and are called according to his purpose, Romans 8:28. But God is not the author of evil. He is not the cause of evil. God does not cause the human will to do evil. Joshua 24:15, literally, "Choose this day whom you will serve." Make the choice. It's yours. That's what Augustine would say. In the end, it's free will. It's man chose it. Don't blame God. Muslims are making a blasphemous statement, saying you can blame God. He is the cause of evil and good. That's what Muslims assert. We do not agree with that. I've read some scholars that would say you can find within Islam, it seems fatalistic. Not a doctrine of concurrence. Okay? That's another thing, a way of their sovereignty is warped. It's heretical. It's an idol. Lastly, worship. Worship. Because Muslim falsely thought the Trinity was Father, Mother, and Son, they accused Christians of worshiping the Virgin Mary. Remember the Theotokos, Mother of God, and how that has to be correctly understood to say she is indeed the human mother of the human Jesus. She gave birth to him. But of his divine nature? No, she's not the mother of God. Well, Muslims also accuse Christians of worshiping icons, either icons of Christ. Icons are symbols, right? You could have it on mugs, paintings, drawings, architecture, you name it. Various icons of Christ or Christian saints. Christian apologists could explain the Trinity correctly, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, three persons in one essence. But they had trouble explaining their respect for Mary, that it was not worship in the strict sense. Even back then, they were having trouble. Remember, once we get to the Protestant Reformation, then Catholics are referred to as Roman Catholics from the 16th century on, and then they've gotten even worse. That's where the divide between Protestants and Roman Catholics is much worse than at the Protestant Reformation, because they've added heresies about the Pope and Mary since then. But even back then, they were having trouble because they really respected Mary and used icons a lot. Christians defended the use of icons as teaching aids, and then they turned the accusation of idolatry back upon the Muslims who believed in spirits they called jinn, J-I-N-N, spirits that were created by fire that had to be warded off by magic. There's crazy things in the Hadith if you start reading through them, okay? I'll just say this. Within Catholicism, later on, they make a distinction between latria and dulia. Latria and dulia. Latria is worship proper of God alone. And dulia has the idea of service or respect. And they claim that that's what's given to Mary and not latria. But what R.C. Sproul would say too is you end up with very fine distinctions that are made logically within Catholicism, but onward eventually in Roman Catholicism. One thing to note here, and this is very important. So, was the Muslim critique of how they venerated Mary valid? Most Protestants would say yes. Just because someone's not a Christian, someone's a pagan, or someone's an atheist, or someone's a Muslim, doesn't mean that every criticism they have of Christianity is false. You get me? Just because they're a pagan, or just because they're a non-Christian in any way or a Muslim, doesn't mean every criticism they have of me and you is false. No. Sometimes they're accurate. It's true. And we have to be willing, humbly, to say perhaps they needed to not venerate Mary as much. Right? But they did the best they could, defending Christianity against Islam. But you and I, we need to think through these same issues on the Trinity, the incarnation of Christ, the eternal Son of God, truly man, two natures in one person, divine sovereignty, God's not the author of evil. Again, here, too, power is not the greatest attribute of God. Remember Pastor Ron sharing the debate? Was it Boyce and Sproul? Yeah. Is it holiness? Yeah. That we would say that there's complete balance in God, right? That one is not, one of his attributes is never greater than any of the other attributes of God. In that sense, we philosophically we say he's a simple being, can't be cut into parts, right? He's just as much justice as he is love, right? And you go on for every attribute of his, right? He's complete, perfect in every way in that sense, not unbalanced toward one or the other, but, you know, Sproul would probably say, holy, holy, holy. The threefold emphasis of that before the throne in Isaiah 6 sets him apart from everything, because it's that transcendence of God as creator and God himself that would set him apart from everything. But in any case, this ends the three-part lecture series on Islam in church history. Hopefully you find it valuable when you're thinking through where we're at today. I found it very valuable myself, chewing on all of it. So, Lord willing, next time we'll meet, we'll move forward from here.